Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 13th Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Ukraine, Biden warns Putin of severe costs, by Jim Heintz and Amir Madhani. Kroger-owned grocery stores. Business booms, but workers are left behind, by Sapna Maheshwari and Michael Corkery. Catholic identity. Diocese to review high schools. Two Regis Jesuit teachers were fired after a student publication had an opinion column on abortion, by Elizabeth Hernandez. Legislature. Bills target port pirates, retail thieves who sell stolen goods online, by Elise Schmelzer. Biden warns Putin of severe costs, by Jim Heintz and Amir Madhani. Russia denies intent to invade, but more than 100,000 troops at borders. The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. President Joe Biden told Russia's Vladimir Putin that invading Ukraine would cause widespread human suffering. He said the West is committed to diplomacy to end the crisis, but is equally prepared for other scenarios, the White House said Saturday. It offered no suggestion that the hour-long call diminished the threat of an imminent war in Europe. Biden also said the United States and its allies would respond decisively and impose swift and severe costs if the Kremlin attacked its neighbor, according to the White House. The two presidents spoke a day after Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, warned that U.S. intelligence shows a Russian invasion could begin within days and before the Winter Olympics and next Sunday in Beijing. Russia denies it intends to invade, but has massed more than 100,000 troops near the Ukrainian border and has sent troops to exercises in neighboring Belarus, encircling Ukraine on three sides. U.S. officials say Russia's buildup of firepower has reached the point where it could invade on short notice. The conversation came at a critical moment for what has become the biggest security crisis between Russia and the West since the Cold War. U.S. officials believe they have mere days to prevent an invasion and enormous bloodshed in Ukraine. And although the U.S. and its NATO allies have no plans to send troops to Ukraine to fight Russia, an invasion and resulting punishing sanctions could reverberate far beyond the former Soviet Republic, affecting energy supplies, global markets, and the power balance in Europe. President Biden was clear with President Putin that while the United States remained prepared to engage in diplomacy in full coordination with our allies and partners, we are equally prepared for other scenarios, the White House statement said. The call was professional and substantive, but produced no fundamental change in the dynamic that has been unfolding now for several weeks, according to a senior administration official who briefed reporters after the call. The official added that it remains unclear whether Putin has made a final decision to move forward with military action. Uri Ushakov, Putin's top foreign policy aide, said that although tensions have been escalating for months in recent days, the situation has simply been brought to the point of absurdity. He said Biden mentioned the possible sanctions that could be imposed on Russia, but this issue was not the focus during a fairly long conversation with the Russian leader. Before talking to Biden, Putin had a telephone call with French President Emmanuel Macron, who met with him in Moscow last week to try to resolve the crisis. A Kremlin summary of Saturday's call suggested little progress was made toward cooling the tensions. Putin complained in the call that the United States and NATO have not responded satisfactorily to Russian demands that Ukraine be prohibited from joining the military alliance and that NATO pull back forces from Eastern Europe. In a sign that American officials are getting ready for a worst-case scenario, the United States announced plans to evacuate most of its staff from the embassy in the Ukrainian capital, and Britain joined other European nations in urging its citizens to leave Ukraine. The timing of any possible Russian military action remained a key question. The U.S. picked up intelligence that Russia is looking at Wednesday as a target date, according to a U.S. official familiar with the findings. The official would not say how definitive the intelligence was. Kroger-owned grocery stores. Business booms, but workers are left behind, by Sapna Maheshwari and Michael Corkery, the New York Times company. When Enrique Romero Jr. finishes his shift fulfilling online orders at a Fred Meyer grocery store in Bellingham, Washington, he often walks to a nearby plasma donation center. There he has his blood drained and a hydrating solution is pumped into his veins, which leaves him tired and cold. Romero, 30, said selling his plasma made him feel like cattle, but the income he earns from it, roughly $500 a month, is more reliable than his wages at Fred Meyer, which is owned by grocery giant Kroger. His part-time hours often fluctuate, and he struggles to find enough money to cover his rent, groceries, and the regular repairs required to keep his 2007 Chevy Aveo on the road. "The economy we have is grueling," he said. Business has boomed during the pandemic for Kroger, the biggest supermarket chain in the United States and the fourth largest employer in the Fortune 500. It owns more than 2,700 locations, and its brands include Harris Teeter, Fred Meyer, Ralph's, Smith's, Pick and Save, and even Murray's Cheese in New York City. The company, based in Cincinnati, said in December that it was expecting sales growth of at least 13.7% over 2 years. The company's stock has risen about 36% over the past year. But that success has not trickled down to its vast workforce of nearly 500,000 employees, many of whom have reported being homeless, receiving government food stamps, or relying on food banks to feed their families. A brief strike in Colorado last month by workers represented by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union at dozens of Kroger-owned King Soopers locations brought renewed scrutiny to the issues of pay and working conditions for grocery workers who have been on the front lines throughout the pandemic. The Economic Roundtable, a nonprofit research group that surveyed more than 10,000 Kroger workers in Washington, Colorado, and Southern California for a report commissioned by four units of the Food Workers Union, found that about 75% said they were food insecure, meaning they lacked consistent access to enough food for an active, healthy life. About 14% said they were homeless or had been homeless in the previous year, and 63% said they did not earn enough money to pay for basic expenses each month. There is a race to the bottom that's been going on for a while with Walmart and other large retail stores and also restaurants, and to reverse that trend is not easy, said Daniel Flaming, president of the Economic Roundtable. Kroger was the sole employer for 86% of those surveyed, partly because more than half had schedules that changed at least every week, making it difficult to commit to another employer. About two-thirds said they were part-time workers, even though they wanted more hours. Keeping workers part-time is a strategy that employers use to encourage turnover and reduce costs. Crystal Howard, a spokesperson for Kroger, said the report was one-dimensional and does not tell the complete story. Kroger has provided an incredible number of people with their first job, second chances, and lifelong careers, and we're proud to play this role in our communities, she said. Howard added that the company had raised its national average hourly rate of pay to $16.68 from $13.66 in 2017, a 22% increase, and that its benefits package included health care, retirement savings, tuition assistance, and on-demand access to mental health assistance. Some of the workers said that even though other retailers and fast food restaurants had started offering higher starting wages than Kroger, the company's health insurance and retirement benefits, which the union negotiated, were more generous than what other employers offered. Other part-time Kroger workers say they stay on the job because they don't want to lose their seniority and the chance for a full-time role. Despite some of the wage increases and benefits, working at a grocery store no longer provides the stable income and middle-class lifestyle that it did 30 years ago, workers say. The Economic Roundtable report studied contracts dating back to 1990 and said the most experienced clerks, known as journeymen, in Southern California made about $28 per hour in today's dollars while working full-time schedules. Wages for top-paid clerks today are 22% lower, and those workers are far more likely to be working part-time hours. Ashley Manning, a 32-year-old floral manager at a Ralph's in San Pedro, California, works full-time but is regularly strapped for cash. Manning, the single mother of a 12-year-old, said she had worked at Ralph's for 9 years and earned $18.25 an hour. It took her 4 years to reach full-time status, which guarantees 40 hours a week and comes with an annual bonus ranging from $500 to $3,000. She said she struggled to pay rent and moved into her grandmother's house after being evicted last spring. She has needed help from her family to help pay for a car. She has tried to make extra money through a party planning and decorating business, but demand for those services dried up in the pandemic. "I would think, I have a good job and make decent money, and I don't," Manning said. "I'm still on the poverty level." Kroger has one of the country's starkest gaps between a CEO's compensation and that of the median employee. Rodney McMullen, Kroger's CEO since 2014, earned $22.4 million in 2020, while the median employee earned $24,617, a ratio of 909 to 1. The average CEO-to-worker pay ratio in the S&P 500 is 299 to 1, with grocery chains such as Costco 193 to 1 and Publix 153 to 1 lower than that. These disparities have fomented outrage among employees who are also dealing with issues such as fights over masks and theft and violence in stores. In the Denver area, more than 8,000 workers at the Kroger-owned King Soopers chain walked off the job last month when union contract negotiations broke down over wages, employee safety issues, and scheduling. Around the time of the strike, a nonprofit publication, A More Perfect Union, published an internal Kroger document in which the company acknowledged that 1 in 5 of its employees received government assistance in 2017. The document also included research showing that employee turnover was lower in places where it raised wages. In response, Kroger said it had developed an improvement plan after the analysis, which included the wage increase and steps to improve tuition assistance and retirement benefits. The company commissioned its own study that stated last month that Kroger's average pay and benefits in Colorado and 3 other Western states were higher than those of other retailers. After more than a week of picketing, the union, Local 7 of the UFCW, won large concessions, including wage increases of more than $5 an hour for some workers and a plan to move at least 500 part-time workers into full-time roles within a few months. As successful as the strike was for workers in Colorado, Larry Cohen, former president of the Communications Workers of America, said the contracts covered only employees at specific Kroger chains, making it difficult for unions to gain broader leverage. "When all contracts are local, how do you deal with a giant national company?" Cohen said. "Not very well." Kroger has controlled labor expenses tightly during the pandemic. The company offered hero pay and thank you bonuses to workers in the early months of the pandemic, but ended those well before vaccinations were available. Grocery workers also were not given priority for vaccinations in many states. Although some municipalities, such as Los Angeles and Seattle, sought to institute hazard pay mandates, Kroger and grocery lobbying associations fought such efforts. Kroger's resistance to wage increases peaked last year when the Los Angeles City Council approved a hazard pay mandate requiring large grocers and pharmacies to pay employees an additional $5 an hour for 4 months. In response, Kroger said it would close 3 stores in the area in May, 2 Ralph's locations and a Food for Less, blaming increased costs. The company pointed to a release at the time that said the stores were underperforming, but city council members were left with the sense that the closures were retaliatory. Paul Koretz, a member of the council, said he had dealt with backlash from some constituents about the impending closing of a Ralph's in his district, a go-to for the local Orthodox Jewish community. He said Ralph's representatives had warned him that they would close the store if the mandate was instituted. "I'm not sure I really believe that Ralph's would do it," he said. "It just seems so counterintuitive that you would mess with your very loyal customers." Shoppers in his district have adapted since the store closed, but he said he believed that the impact of the closings probably had a chilling effect on other municipalities considering similar measures. Catholic Identity, diocese to review high schools. 2 Regis Jesuit teachers were fired after a student publication had an opinion column on abortion by Elizabeth Hernandez, the Denver Post. The Archdiocese of Denver plans to review the theology curriculum, hiring practices, and Catholic identity of the high schools under its purview after the retraction of a student publication and the firing of 2 teachers at Regis Jesuit High School late last year, according to emails and documents obtained by the Denver Post. Regis Jesuit teachers and magazine advisors Maria Lynch and Nicole Arduini were fired December 22nd after administrators removed the winter edition of the school's student publication from the internet because it featured a student opinion column arguing abortion should remain legal. "I'm sad that my school chose to save face rather than support a teacher they know is dedicated to her profession, her faith, and the pro-life movement, and it hurts to feel unwelcome in the Catholic schools I've committed my whole professional life to building up," Lynch said in an interview with the Denver Post. School principal and theology teacher Jimmy Trico emailed the 2 teachers on December 16th, the same day the winter edition of the student magazine Elevate was published, and told them the student's column on abortion rights was provocative, but would make for good conversation, according to the message provided to the Post by Lynch. 2 days later, Regis Jesuit fired Lynch and Arduini for poor judgment, personal misconduct on the premises that caused scandal and seriously damaged the reputation of the school, and for not supporting the mission and faith dimensions of Regis Jesuit High School, according to a document provided by Lynch. The teachers' firings were followed by an admonishing letter from Denver Archbishop Samuel Aquila to the Regis Jesuit community. That letter, dated one day after the firing, called the publication of the student's column a failure and said that faculty members and staff members of Catholic schools must oppose abortion. Aquila wrote he was grateful for the way the situation was handled. Regis Jesuit High School administrators denied the Archdiocese of Denver was behind the firing of Lynch and Arduini. Representatives of the school and the Archdiocese declined to be interviewed for the story. David Card, the school's president, released a statement saying Jesuit educators' role is to mitigate the divisive, destructive rhetoric that permeates every modern social and cultural issue by helping our students develop their own productive, nuanced understanding of the turbulent world they're soon to enter as adults. He acknowledged the school is reviewing its student journalism program and magazine, but in doing so, he said, We are not lessening our commitment to these Jesuit education principles or to our institutional faith as a Roman Catholic high school. Assessing schools' Catholic identity. The December incident prompted discussions between officials at the Archdiocese and Regis Jesuit about how to move forward. According to an email obtained by the Post sent by Regis administration to the school's faculty, the Archdiocese plans to increase intervention in the region's Catholic high schools from providing a new prompt for theology teacher applicants during the school's hiring processes to asking schools to submit their theology curriculum to the Archdiocese. The superintendent also mentioned a process for accreditation the Archdiocese is creating to assess the Catholic identity of our high schools, the email said. Details about the plan were not immediately clear. Regis Jesuit spokeswoman Cherise Broderick King said the school is an independent Catholic school in the Archdiocese of Denver, meaning the Archdiocese has no direct oversight of school operations except for approving theology course curriculum and endorsing those hired to teach theology. The Archdiocese has no financial responsibilities toward or from the school, Broderick King said. Because the school and Archdiocese are separate entities, Broderick King said, it would be inappropriate for Regis to comment on or speculate about any of the Archdiocese's new initiatives, including the proposed accreditation process. When asked to comment on the new policies, Archdiocese of Denver spokesman Mark Haas wrote in an email, "It is the responsibility of the local bishop, as prescribed in the canon law of the Catholic Church, to ensure all the local Catholic schools in his diocese, both archdiocesan and independent, are grounded in the principles of Catholic doctrine." Quoting canon law, Haas said the diocesan bishop has a right to watch over and visit the Catholic schools in his territory and issue directives that pertain to the general regulation of Catholic schools, and that no school is to bear the name Catholic school without the consent of competent ecclesiastical authority. Aquila will leave day-to-day administrative, operational, and personnel matters to the school's leadership team, Haas wrote. But the Archbishop is committed to ensuring families with children in Catholic schools can be confident their students are receiving a Catholic education faithful to the Church's teachings. There are nearly 40 Catholic schools under the purview of the Denver Archdiocese. A better way to handle difficult conversations. Lynch, who described herself as a committed Catholic, is speaking out about her firing after refusing to sign a non-disclosure agreement presented by the school. The agreement wouldn't allow me to tell the truth if it was disparaging to Regis, and I wanted to have the freedom to defend myself as a woman of faith, a pro-life advocate, and a devoted teacher, Lynch said. Lynch moved to Denver in 2016 to work at Regis Jesuit after employment at the University of Notre Dame. Lynch taught Spanish and journalism at Regis Jesuit, was heavily involved in clubs and committees, and was the administration's most recent nominee to renowned National Jesuit Leadership Program. Lynch described Jesuit schools as bastions of intellectual freedom and faith-filled, justice-oriented people who don't shy away from discussions and disagreement. The Jesuits are considered to be a more liberal order of the Catholic Church. The fired teacher pointed to a quote in the school's hallway as embodying that Jesuit tenet. Doubt comes in at the window when denied the door. I believe that, Lynch said. I am pro-life and consider Regis Jesuit to be so too, but not all of our students are. My first thought when this happened was of them and of all my acquaintances who have questions about the church and its teaching. What message does this censorship and firing send to them? Catholic schools need to show that we can confront students' questions and work through their doubts with them. This move by Regis looks like an admission that they aren't confident that the church's teachings and its teachers can respond to a 14-year-old's initial questions about abortion. Lynch said she shared her anti-abortion beliefs frequently and fearlessly with her classes and colleagues while encouraging students to speak up in class discussions and writing. Last year, one of Lynch's students said in class that she thought Regis Jesuit would be too judgmental of a place to be pregnant. In response, Lynch prepared a presentation. Her class studied the church's anti-abortion teachings and discussed how they could make the school community a place where any student would be comfortable to choose life. I want all students to be able to express their views, not because I agree with everything they say, but because I think that's the best way to address their questions, Lynch said. I think we missed an awesome opportunity to present to our student body about the sanctity of life and to see what pro-life opinion pieces would have been submitted for the next issue. Regis Jesuit would not say whether Lynch is eligible to be rehired within the Archdiocese, she said, which means if she wanted to continue teaching at Catholic schools, she would have to move. I am hoping that this event can help the church as an institution find a better way to handle difficult conversations and controversial issues in our Catholic schools, because they aren't going away, Lynch said. Our students have tough questions, need to have the freedom to express them, and deserve open, honest, and frank discussions that can help them understand why the church teaches what she does. Legislature. Bills target porch pirates, retail thieves who sell stolen goods online. By Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. With just a few clicks, online shoppers on Facebook Marketplace can find pictures of stacks of new boxed power tools listed for a fraction of their in-store price. A few clicks more reveal eBay listings for mystery packages, where the shopper pays for a box of unknown goods. Other online listings show piles of unopened letters in the back of vans, billed as unclaimed mail. Many of the items are likely stolen from stores or porches, according to Colorado law enforcement, but connecting the stolen goods for sale to the people selling them is difficult in an online environment that allows anonymity, State Attorney General Phil Weiser said. Reselling stolen goods used to involve the inherent risk of showing up in person to make a transaction. Not anymore. A theft ring can simply create a fake account, click the option to become a third-party seller, post their stolen items online, and ship stolen products anonymously, Weiser said. The ease in which this can be done and the anonymity provided has made retail theft, shoplifting from retailers, as well as theft from porches, a much less risky and much more profitable crime. Colorado lawmakers want to discourage organized rings of thieves from stealing by making it harder for them to resell their loot via online marketplaces such as eBay, Amazon, Craigslist, and Facebook. A bipartisan bill pending in the legislature, HB 22-1099, online marketplaces and third-party sellers, would require people who sell large amounts of new items on the internet to register a slew of personal information with the online marketplaces. People making more than $5,000 in sales or making more than 200 transactions over a 12-month period will have to register their bank account number, contact information, and tax identification number with the marketplace, which will be required to verify the information. Sellers who make more than $20,000 through a marketplace also must disclose their full name, address, and contact information to any customer after purchase. Representative Terry Carver, a Colorado Springs Republican sponsoring the bill, compared the measure to the regulations placed on the brick-and-mortar marketplaces that used to be a common place to sell stolen goods, pawn shops. This is the modern-day equivalent to those rules, she said Thursday at a hearing for the bill in the House Business Affairs and Labor Committee, where lawmakers approved it unanimously. If a seller doesn't comply, the marketplace must suspend their account. Marketplaces that do not comply with the state's requirements could face lawsuits from the Colorado Attorney General's office. The bill would not affect people selling used goods or who make infrequent sales, said sponsor Senator Rob Woodward, a Larimer County Republican. We're trying to find that line where we can identify the big players and separate them from the little guy who has the DeWalt drill from his mom who'd rather have the cash, he said. Big box retailers in Colorado testified that they're losing millions of dollars because of thefts. David Turnus, asset protection manager for Walgreens in Colorado, said employees at one Pueblo store watched helplessly as a woman filled a duffel with cosmetics and walked out the door. They found the stolen goods on Facebook Marketplace less than an hour later, he said. About $3.6 million of Colorado Walgreens stores' losses can be directly attributed to organized retail theft, he said. Some of the chain stores are losing about $1,000 a day. One solution to deter theft is to hire more employees, Turnus said, but retailers have struggled to hire enough workers in the current labor market. Stores that have frequent thefts are often the hardest to staff, compounding the problem. Jamie Bourne, a corporate organized retail crime manager for Home Depot, said stores in Colorado first had to lock up the portable power tools to keep them from being stolen. Then thieves started taking batteries, so they locked those up too. Then bulk wires. We just can't operate our business by locking everything up, he said. Smaller businesses are impacted as well. Kwame Spearman, CEO and co-owner of Tattered Cover, said the chain's bookstores have seen an increase in thefts over the past 2 years. He cited another downtown business that recently implemented a $1 fee per purchase to combat shoplifting losses. We're concerned we might have to take measures like that, he said. The bill's sponsors hope the changes will help law enforcement track down people selling stolen goods online by giving them information with which to begin investigating. This bill will allow us to collect small breadcrumbs of evidence before they disappear into the black hole of the internet, First Judicial District Attorney Alexis King said while testifying Thursday in support of the bill. Colorado law enforcement officers in recent years have busted several rings responsible for the theft of hundreds of thousands of dollars of merchandise. In April, an Arapahoe County grand jury indicted three men on charges alleging they robbed a dozen hardware stores in the region and resold the stolen tools online. The men brandished handguns at store employees during the robberies and several times sprayed employees with pepper spray, according to investigators. 2 months later, investigators in Douglas County arrested seven people accused of making more than $5 million over several years by reselling stolen goods online. The group stole vitamins, cosmetics, birth control, home improvement tools, and other merchandise from large retailers across the state and resold it all online, often out of state and sometimes to different countries, police said. Some Colorado retail stores are losing millions of dollars a year in merchandise, and local governments are losing out on sales tax dollars, said Chris Howes, president of the Colorado Retail Council. They've been able to turn the entire world into an illegal pawn shop, Howes said. Nearly identical bills are being considered in at least 30 other state legislatures because of a coordinated push by retailers' organizations. Arkansas signed a similar bill into law last year. The bill also mirrors federal legislation under consideration, but Colorado lawmakers said there's no reason to wait for Congress to act. Some of the country's largest international online marketplaces, Amazon, eBay, and Etsy, have endorsed the legislation introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives. Legislators, prosecutors, and industry representatives also said the bill was a good first step to combating organized retail theft, although there's more to be done. We're very confident this is going to pass, said sponsor Representative Dylan Roberts, an Avon Democrat. NBC News correspondent to give CU's commencement speech by Annie Mill, The Daily Camera. NBC News correspondent Tom Costello will deliver the University of Colorado's first in-person commencement speech in 2 years. Costello, a CU alumnus, will speak May 5th during the commencement ceremony at Folsom Field, according to a CU news release. In a recent message to the campus community, Chancellor Philip DeStefano announced the return to the traditional in-person format for the 2022 event. Commencement ceremonies have been held virtually the past 2 years because of the pandemic. Costello is an award-winning journalist and Washington, D.C. correspondent for NBC News. He grew up in Centennial and graduated from CU with a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism in 1987. He also has a master's degree in administration and international commerce from Boston University's Graduate Center in Brussels, Belgium. He spent 6 years at Nine News in Denver. He served as CNBC's NASDAQ correspondent in New York from 1999 to 2002 and was working in the city on 9/11. As CNBC's senior correspondent from 2002 to 2004, he produced documentaries in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. He now reports daily across all NBC News and MSNBC platforms, including Today, NBC Nightly News, MSNBC, and NBC News Now. The class of 2022's Senior Class Council is honored to nominate a notable alumnus of CU Boulder, Tom Costello, to speak at our May commencement ceremony, said Julia Baum, president of CU's Senior Class Council, in a news release. He is a spirited leader among today's media outlets, resilient in the face of dismay, and an ethical, fact-based storyteller. In news briefs, train partially derails into river. Several cars of a BNSF railway train derailed from the track Saturday morning and fell into the South Platte River, blocking a trail. Denver police received a call about the train about 7:30 a.m. Saturday, police spokesman Jay Casillas said. No injuries were reported, and police blocked off the area. The derailment blocked the South Platte River Trail near Park Avenue West, Denver Parks and Recreation spokeswoman Cindy Karvasky said. There's no estimated reopening of the trail, she said. The BNSF Railway did not respond to a request for information. In a statement to KMGH-TV, BNSF officials said the derailment happened after the freight train left the rail facility. Seven empty lumber cars derailed, and three fell into the river. The railway company is investigating the cause of the derailment. This is the second incident involving BNSF Railway this week. An employee died Wednesday after being struck by a train in the area of 3700 North Globeville Road. UNC adds degree programs in health sciences and arts, by Line Greeley. New degree programs in health sciences and the arts are on the way to the University of Northern Colorado in the fall as it begins to phase out majors in French and German. The UNC Board of Trustees on Friday approved a new health science bachelor's degree. The program will have an emphasis on healthcare administration and public health. The board, during a meeting on campus, also signed off on new bachelor's degrees in the School of Theater Arts and Dance and the College of Performing and Visual Arts. The degree will be offered in acting, theater design technology, and musical theater. UNC is phasing out bachelor's degrees in French and German because of low enrollment. Former Johnstown police commander arrested on suspicion of stalking. Weld County deputies arrested a former Johnstown police commander this month after he was accused of stalking a woman. The arrest stems from a complaint made in June against Aaron Sanchez, 47, who was commander or second in command for the police department at the time. A woman told the chief she was being continuously followed by Sanchez, according to arrest records. The identity of the woman will not be revealed because of the nature of the case. She has moved from Johnstown. Deputies obtained an arrest warrant and arrested Sanchez on February 3rd on suspicion of stalking. These reports were from Staff and Wire reports. In other news briefs, rapper reportedly among four shot at party, byline Los Angeles. Four people were shot and wounded early Saturday after a fight broke out outside a restaurant hosting a party that followed a Justin Bieber concert, police said. The gunfire erupted outside the Nice Guy restaurant, striking and wounding four men, ages 60, 22, 20, and 19. LAPD officer Lizeth Lamilli said, their names were not released, but NBC News reported rapper Kodak Black was among the wounded. Officers who responded to the scene found two victims. Paramedics took them to the hospital for treatment of wounds that were not life-threatening, police said. Two additional victims went to hospitals on their own, according to the statement. All four victims were listed in stable condition. Detectives asked witnesses to come forward to help them identify the gunman. Videos posted on TMZ.com and on social media show Black posing for photos with a group of people outside the restaurant when the brawl broke out. Black is among several people involved in the brawl when shots rang out, sending everyone at the scene running for cover. Gun sales surge, bring record money for conservation grants. Byline, Billings, Montana. Tax receipts from surging gun and ammunition sales in the U.S. boosted money for a federal conservation program to a record level in 2022, officials announced Friday. Excise taxes on guns, ammunition, and archery equipment brought in $1.1 billion to fund federal grants to states for state wildlife conservation and hunter education, said officials from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. A related program for fish restoration brought in almost $400 million from taxes on fishing equipment and boat fuel, they said. The restoration programs distribute tax money from hunting, shooting, and fishing equipment to all 50 states and U.S. territories. The taxes resulted from a 1937 law that aimed to stop the rapid decline of many species of fish and other animals early last century because of overhunting and habitat destruction. Money for the wildlife program rose by more than 60% over last year and shattered the previous high of $808 million in 2015, according to figures provided by Fish and Wildlife spokesperson Lori Marshall. The increased funding comes after at least 18.5 million firearms were sold last year. These were from Denver Post Wire Services. Canada, border blockade eases. Bridge remains blocked, by Rob Gillies and Mike Householder. The Associated Press, byline Windsor, Ontario. Protesters opposed to COVID-19 vaccine mandates and other restrictions withdrew their vehicles from a key U.S.-Canadian border bridge Saturday, but still blocked access while other demonstrations ramped up in cities across Canada, including the capital, where police said they were awaiting more officers before ending what they described as an illegal occupation. The tense standoff at the Ambassador Bridge linking Detroit and Windsor eased somewhat early in the day when Canadian police persuaded demonstrators to move the trucks they had used to barricade the entrance to the busy international crossing. But protesters reconvened nearby with reinforcements and were still choking off access from the Canadian side late Saturday. Snarling traffic and commerce for a sixth day. In Ottawa, the ranks of protesters swelled to what police said was 4,000 demonstrators. The city has seen that on past weekends, and loud music played as people milled about downtown, where anti-vaccine demonstrators have been encamped since late January. The protests at the bridge in Ottawa and elsewhere have reverberated outside the country, with similarly inspired convoys in France, New Zealand, and the Netherlands. And the U.S. Department of Homeland Security warned that truck convoys may be in the works in the United States. An ex-cabinet minister in Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government took the unusual step of calling out her former federal colleagues, as well as the province and city, for not putting an end to the protests. Amazingly, this isn't just Ottawa. It's the nation's capital, Catherine McKenna tweeted. But no one, not the city, the province, or the federal government, can seem to get their act together to end this illegal occupation. It's appalling. Just get your act together now. Trudeau has called the protesters a fringe of Canadian society, and federal and provincial leaders say they can't order police what to do. Safety concerns arising from aggressive illegal behavior by many demonstrators limited police enforcement capabilities, Ottawa police said late Saturday. Ottawa police said a joint command center had been set up with the Ontario Provincial Police and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Police earlier issued a statement calling the protests an unlawful occupation and saying they were waiting for police reinforcements before implementing a plan to end the demonstrations. Ottawa Mayor Jim Watson declared a state of emergency last week for the capital, where hundreds of trucks remained in front of the parliament buildings, and demonstrators have set up portable toilets outside the prime minister's office, where Trudeau's motorcade usually parks. Surrounded by dozens of officers in Windsor, a man with Mandate Freedom and Trump 2024 spray-painted on his vehicle left the bridge entrance early in the day as others began dismantling a small tarp-covered encampment. A trucker honked his horn as he too drove off to cheers and chants of freedom. But hundreds more arrived to bolster the crowd and settled into a face-off with police about two blocks away, waving flags and yelling. Although there were no visible physical confrontations, the crowd still controlled the road to the bridge, and traffic had not resumed as of the evening. Windsor police tweeted that no one had been arrested, but urged people to stay away from the bridge. We appreciate the cooperation of the demonstrators at this time, and we will continue to focus on resolving the demonstration peacefully. Avoid area. Protester Daniel Koss said shortly before police advanced that the demonstration had succeeded in bringing attention to demands to lift COVID-19 mandates, and he was happy it remained peaceful. It's a win-win, Koss said. The pandemic is rolling down right now. They can remove the mandates, all the mandates, and everyone's happy. The government does the right thing, and the protesters are all happy. The previous day, a judge ordered an end to the blockade of mostly pickups and cars, and Ontario Premier Doug Ford declared a state of emergency, allowing for fines of $100,000 Canadian and up to 1 year in jail for anyone illegally blocking roads, bridges, walkways, and other critical infrastructure. The illegal blockades are impacting trade, supply chains, and manufacturing. They're hurting Canadian families, workers, and businesses. Glad to see the Windsor Police and its policing partners commenced enforcement at and near the Ambassador Bridge, Federal Innovation Minister François-Philippe Champagne tweeted Saturday. These blockades must stop. The Ambassador Bridge is the busiest U.S.-Canadian border crossing, carrying 25% of all trade between the two countries, and auto plants on both sides have been forced to shut down or reduce production. Selling Trump, a very profitable post-presidency like no other, by Shane Goldmacher and Eric Lipton, the New York Times company. In early December, Donald Trump put on a tuxedo and boarded a private jet of a scrap metal magnate and crypto miner for a short flight across Florida, touching down at an airport in Naples. There, a long red carpet marked the pathway into a Christmas-decorated hangar filled with supporters of Trump who had paid $10,000 to $30,000 for the privilege of attending a party and taking a photo with him. The event had all the trappings of a typical high-end fundraiser, a giant American flag, a lectern, chandeliers, and an open bar. Frank Stallone's band provided the music. An anti-Biden Let's Go Brandon banner hung from the rafters. But the money raised did not go to Trump's political operation. Instead, Trump's share of the evening's proceeds went straight into his pocket, according to a person familiar with the arrangement. Multiple attendees said they bought their tickets from a private company, Whip Fundraising, whose founder, Brad Keltner, has asserted that the lion's share went to charity, but the website advertising for the event listed no charitable cause. And Keltner, reached by phone, declined to discuss how money was distributed. In the years since Trump has left the White House, he has undertaken a wide-ranging set of money-making ventures, trading repeatedly on his political fame and fan base in pursuit of profit. Much as he did while in the White House, Trump has thoroughly blurred the lines between his political ambitions and his business interests. He has gone on an arena tour with former Fox News host Bill O'Reilly, where a backstage VIP package sold for more than $7,500. He has published a $75 coffee table book after being paid a multi-million dollar advance by a new publishing company co-founded by his eldest son. He has turned an online Trump store into a MAGA merchandiser, with his company sending marketing missives to people on his 2020 campaign's email list. That store is now selling red Make America Great Again hats for $50 each, a $20 markup from the price currently offered by his political action committee, with all proceeds going to a Trump-owned company. His wife, Melania, has gotten into the act too, auctioning off online collectibles and scheduling her own big-ticket event in Naples in April, a Tulips and Topiaries high tea, with VIP packages reaching $50,000 and an undisclosed portion going to charity. For Trump, the monetization of his post-presidency represents a return to his roots. He expertly leveraged his celebrity as the host of The Apprentice and his image as a decisive businessman to build credibility when he first entered politics. Now he is executing the same playbook, only in reverse, converting a political following that provided hundreds of millions of dollars in small campaign contributions into a base of consumers for all things branded Trump. There are grandiose enterprises, such as a fledgling social media company whose billion-dollar market capitalization is largely predicated on Trump's direct personal involvement. And there are smaller ones, like remodeling the lobby bar of Trump Tower in Manhattan and renaming it the 45 Wine and Whiskey Bar, where specialty cocktails range in price up to, yes, $45. That one comes with two American beef sliders and can be sipped in dark velvet chairs surrounded by Trump's black and white presidential portraits and paraphernalia. You come here, you drink Trump, said Daniel Popescu, a 79-year-old architect and a bar regular, whose typical order is a $20 glass of Trump Blanc de Blanc sparkling wine. He hailed Trump on a recent evening as the best president this country has ever had. For a billionaire to give up his life to do good for the country, Popescu said with a shake of his head and a sip, it's unbelievable. Other past presidents have cashed in financially after leaving the White House. Barack and Michelle Obama reportedly sold a joint book deal for $65 million. Bill and Hillary Clinton's speech making after leaving the White House was estimated to have netted them $153 million by spring 2015, when Hillary Clinton announced her run for president. George W. Bush has been a mainstay on the speaking circuit, too. But no former president has been more determined to meld his business interests, from chocolate bars to real estate to a tech startup, with a continuing political operation and capitalize on that for personal gain. Taylor Budowich, a spokesperson for Trump, noted Trump had been wealthy before seeking public office. After sacrificing considerably to lead our nation, there continues to be unprecedented demand for President Trump, his thoughts, and his products, unlike anything politics has ever seen, Budowich said. Eric Trump, the executive vice president of the Trump Organization, added that direct consumer sales and Trump's public appearances were worth a modest amount of money compared with the organization's real estate deals and other major ventures. We've had an exceptional year as a company, he said. Blurred lines between profit and politics. Any division between Trump's business and his political operation can be hard to discern. At his first campaign-style rallies of 2022 in Arizona and Texas, giant television screens paid for by Trump's PAC advertised his $75 picture book. His political operation has promoted the book in emails to his supporters, as has his official post-presidential office, which also issued a recent statement promoting a Trump property in Miami. Lawrence Noble, former general counsel at the Federal Election Commission, said the combination of ways that Trump had monetized his life after the White House while remaining intimately involved in Republican politics and a possible future candidate himself had created ethical questions unlike any post-presidency in modern times. The thing that is different about Trump is the money-making part seems to have permeated everything, Noble said. There is this appearance, at least, that he is always thinking, how can I make a profit off of this? Trump faced similar questions while president, as he frequently promoted, patronized, and profited from his private properties, including internationally. Watchdogs who worried then about his selling access remained concerned. It is wrong for influence and power in this country to be sold for personal profit, Noble said. Out of office, Trump faces new formal limits on his business dealings, although if he were to run again in 2024, Some of his financial activity would be revealed on future disclosures. His political action committees have even fewer constraints than his re-election campaign account did. In 2021, Trump's political committee spent more than $600,000 on Trump properties for rent, meals, meeting expenses, and hotel stays, records show. His PAC continued to make monthly $37,541.67 rent payments to Trump Tower Commercial LLC. The $375,000 the PAC paid in Trump Tower rent was more than the total of $350,000 that Trump's group donated to the scores of federal and state-level political candidates he endorsed in 2021. Many of those candidates, in turn, redirected funds back to Trump, holding lavish events at his properties. Herschel Walker, whom Trump recruited to run for Senate in Georgia, spent more than $135,000 at Mar-a-Lago, Trump's private Florida club. The Republican National Committee forked over $175,000 for a fundraiser there in the spring. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.